Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
Across this country, many Americans are sitting at the kitchen table. They're scanning the classifieds. They're updating their resumes or sending out another job application, hoping that this time they'll hear back from a potential employer. And they're filled with a sense of uncertainty about where their next paycheck will come from. And I know the only thing that will entirely free them of those worries, the only thing that will fully lift that sense of uncertainty, is the security of a new job.
That was President Barack Obama in July. Last week, new unemployment figures for August revealed that nearly one out of every 10 workers in the U.S. is currently out of a job. The nation is struggling with how to deal with all the people thrown out of work by the bad economy. And this summer, the federal government extended unemployment benefits for millions of people who've lost their jobs. This Labor Day, we're going to take a look back at the long history of unemployment. Turns out the modern experience of joblessness first started in Massachusetts in the 1800s, long before the Great Depression. Alex Kasar is a historian at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and he's the author of Out of Work, The First Century of Unemployment in Massachusetts. Kasar says the focus on the unemployed really began with a different economic crisis. The financial panic of 1873 led to the belief that 250,000 people were jobless in Massachusetts. State officials didn't buy that. So the Massachusetts Bureau of Statistics and Labor went on the hunt for a better and more politically tolerable figure.
The first attempt to count the unemployed anywhere in the United States occurred in Massachusetts in the 1870s, near the end of a very long depression. And that attempt to count the unemployed was clearly and explicitly designed to establish that there was very little unemployment. And they set up the count in such a way as to get that result, but they didn't quite. Part of what's notable about this is that from the beginning, there's been something very politically charged about unemployment statistics. From the beginning, there's always been a sense of certain people trying to establish that the number is large and other groups trying to say, no, 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 we don't really have a serious problem.
When Massachusetts decided to try to count once and for all how many unemployed workers it had, knowing that the federal government was claiming it had about 250,000, it ended up counting 22,000. So the number drops from 250,000 to 22,000. How does a number drop that steeply?
Well, they used a very interesting methodology to arrive at that number. For one thing, they did not survey individuals. The main way they got the number was to go around to police chiefs around the state, and they went to each police chief and said, how many people are unemployed in your town, and count only those who you think really want to work.
Versus those who are just loafers at their core.
Exactly. In the 1870s, one can see a shift in the meaning of the word unemployed. The word unemployed in the 1875 Massachusetts census applied to people who customarily did not work. There were hundreds of thousands of people listed as unemployed, and most of them were children under the age of 10. And in a very short period of time, the word flipped its definition to refer to people who normally did work but were unable to find a job.
Alex Kasar, is part of the reason that Massachusetts really wanted to find out exactly how many unemployed we had, is that if we had many more unemployed people than we thought, it crushed this whole idea of the United States as a land of opportunity with endless jobs, and they wanted to find out once and for all, well, how many jobs and how many workers are there?
Well, that was certainly part of the middle class notion, and I would say even the notion embedded in the elites of the country. Part of what was interesting when I started to go into the sources was that, in fact, working class people knew that there had been unemployment for many decades. I mean, for example, boot and shoe workers, and that was one of the two largest industries in Massachusetts at the time. There were hundreds of thousands of boot and shoe workers, and about 50 to 60% of them were unemployed seasonally every year. They knew that they didn't work year-round, but it did violate the official mythology.
You've written that it wasn't until after the Civil War that unemployment became a formal concept. What was it before, if not a formal concept?
It was part of a kind of continuum or spectrum of experiences of discontinuous work. People who are self-employed, if they own their own farms, own their own shops, can control the rhythms and timing and pace of their work. They can control which tasks they do when. It's when you become an employee that you become subject to unemployment, and that's a process that takes place over the 19th century. The second thing which happens, and which leads to it becoming a formal concept, is that people come to depend on working year-round and having an income year-round. So you're an employee and you need to work.
You're referring here to this enormous shift in Massachusetts society over the 1800s, where at the beginning of the century, most people were self-employed. They owned farms, they were involved in agriculture. And for those people, even if it was a bad crop season or there wasn't work to do, they still had a roof over their heads, they were still growing their own food and could maybe make their own clothes.
Absolutely. Or even if you think about one of the classic cases of New England industrialization, which is the young women who went to work in the textile mills of Lowell and elsewhere. Well, when work got slack there, they went back to the farms that they had grown up on. So they were not experiencing need in what we think of as a modern way.
But when society shifted to manufacturing and industry and people became worker bees, when that factory was shuttered, they were wage dependent. There were no wages.
That's exactly right. And it is wage dependence that transforms the society in the course of the 19th century and then leads to this phenomenon.
The other phenomenon you talk about is this recognition that unemployment is actually a social problem. It has a domino effect in which you don't just have money today. That lack of money creates medical problems, poverty problems. Your children can't get educated. There's a line in your book that says, itself a malady. Unemployment creates conditions in which other diseases fester and spread. Right. So ignoring unemployment means you're allowing a host of other social ills to come cascading in.
And that was a recognition which, in fact, took about 40 years after the first count. By about 1915, you start seeing a recognition that this isn't a problem whose consequences are immediate or confined to the people who are unemployed for a particular set of months. And as they begin to look at the lives of the unemployed, they see this as a social phenomenon which is influencing a variety of things, including crime, for example. They see it influencing crime rates, influencing the ability of children to go to school. One of the reasons that children were sent into the workplace in the late 19th century was to serve as a kind of insurance policy against the unemployment of adults.
According to your research, Massachusetts was a pioneer in the evolution of unemployment policy. Is pioneering as simple as people should get out-of-work benefits if they're out of work?
There were really three different approaches to unemployment. One was to try to create jobs somehow for the unemployed, whether through public works or through some kind of make work. I mean, the classic and to modern eyes or ears, a grotesque example was to have people report to a homeless shelter they could stay the night, and in the morning they had to chop rocks and chop stone to demonstrate their willingness to work, or they would chop wood that would be used later to fuel the place. And then there were other examples of that. Maybe we should build bridges now, but that they would do some work in return for receiving some aid. So one is to provide work. Another is to provide what was then called relief, simply give some money to people who are really, really needy. And then the third approach gradually became the notion of unemployment insurance. The first unemployment insurance bill to be introduced anywhere in the United States was introduced in Massachusetts in 1916.
That idea you referenced about this feeling that if we're going to give you something to survive on while you're unemployed, you at least have to chop wood or chop rocks, seems to get at this idea that people just have this concern that if you're not working, you're lazy.
There is this almost transhistorical suspicion that people who are poor and not working are loafing and just trying to live off the dole. In the 1890s, you see these charity associations in Boston. These are well-meaning people who want to help. And the way they respond to the state is to say, we'll raise some money and the state can kick in some money too, but we will serve a special function for you, which is that we will go to the homes of everybody who wants relief and investigate to make sure that they are truly worthy.
The idea of the welfare mom sitting at home watching television, collecting the paycheck.
Exactly. I mean, Ronald Reagan's iconic image of the welfare mom who drives to the welfare office in a Cadillac was an image of the Irish woman who was sitting in Dorchester in the, you know, in the late 1890s. And maybe there was actually milk in the refrigerator and she didn't need it, or perhaps even worse, she might have had gentleman callers.
So you've written that in Massachusetts in the late 1800s and early 1900s, unemployed people protested. They went to the State House, and that actually got them some action.
In the 1890s, Boston itself was the scene of extraordinary demonstrations of the unemployed, led by a man named Morrison Swift, who was... We would call him an outside agitator today. He lived in Massachusetts some of the time. Originally, he came from Ohio. He organized protests of the unemployed in the 1890s, in 1907, 1908, and in 1914, 1915 in Boston. And in the 1890s, he started organizing daily protests of thousands of people demanding the right to work, demanding that the state government do something about it, that the state provide jobs. They got a petition. He went in and he demanded to meet with the governor, who did meet with him. And then the governor came out and gave a little talk to the thousands of the unemployed, telling them that they were shiftless and lazy. And as a result, they stormed the State House and took over the State House building for a day.
Did it ultimately achieve anything?
Yes, it did. In fact, they were dismissed. Everyone said these are rowdy agitators, et cetera. This was the normal pattern with unemployed protests. They were denounced. And then a commission was created that really did some serious research and launched some public aid programs. And then another lost from view but extraordinary thing that happens in Massachusetts in 1920, 1921, after World War I, when there's a very, very sharp downturn, a strange character named Urbain Ledoux, whose nickname was Mr. Zero for reasons largely lost to history, began organizing the unemployed. He created a shelter for them, which was known as the Hotel Jobless. And one day he led a group of them onto the Boston Common and began auctioning them off as slaves. By the second or third day he did this, there were tens of thousands of people gathered on the Boston Common.
Bidding for cheap labor?
Well, these were largely people who were sympathetic, but there was this kind of savage parody going on here. This is Boston, the home of abolitionism, and we have people who are so desperate that they would be willing to be sold off into slavery in order to receive food and shelter. Those protests received a tremendous amount of national and international attention, leading Urbain Ledoux to eventually have meetings with the President of the United States and others. And crazy as it was, it did produce some results in terms of public works programs and opening of new shelters and providing food to the homeless unemployed.
Correct me if I'm wrong, we really don't see that so much today. Why is that?
That's one of the remarkable contrasts between the present and the past. And it's something which I'm asked about fairly often, which is that, you know, we have millions and millions of people who are out of work. And I don't think I have seen a notice anywhere in the press about any protest of the unemployed. It's quite extraordinary.
And is that because the unemployed are too busy trying to find jobs or too depressed to come out and protest?
I think it's partly that the psychological reaction initially can be a depressive one. I don't think it's that people are too busy trying to find jobs, because a lot of the long-term unemployed, you know, have tried to find a job everywhere that they could look. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that people are unclear about what a solution is that they could demand. I mean, the fact is that unemployment's very decentralized. We talk about a 10% or even a 15 to 16%, but it doesn't take the form of workplaces shutting down entirely or half the labor force being shut off. In a few places, it's like that. It's much more a certain percentage of the labor force is laid off in a lot of different places. There is not an organic solidarity among these people. And without an organizing group to try to sort of organize them together and precipitate it, I think they are left feeling isolated and feeling like the solution to their problem is not a collective one. It's an individual one. I mean, if you are an unemployed dock worker and somebody else is an unemployed radio technician in a different state, it isn't clear what your common demand is.
We're talking with Harvard Kennedy School historian Alex Kasar about the history of unemployment in Massachusetts. Obviously, unemployment today is an enormous issue in the United States. Do you have a sense of how unemployment around the turn of the 20th century compared to the unemployment rate in the country today?
The unemployment rate in the United States has not changed very much.
Percentage-wise
in the last 140 years. It changes all the time. It goes up and down. But the range of unemployment statistics has been roughly steady. That's to say, in the best years, unemployment is about, you know, 4, 5, maybe 6%. And in the worst years, it goes up to somewhere in the vicinity of 10%, maybe 11%. Now, I mean, one long-run change that has occurred is that, in fact, we haven't seen a figure like 4% unemployment in quite a long time. So there may, in recent decades, be a drift upward. But the overall portrait is that the unemployment percentage fluctuates between something like 5 and something like 11% most of the time.
So what then are your thoughts about the situation today? Are we making a bigger deal of the problem in the country than it really deserves when you look at the history of unemployment in the U.S.?
No, it's a very big deal. The point of saying it hasn't changed so much is not to say that it's not a big deal. It's to say that it remains a very important issue and a very critical issue. I mean, we're talking about unemployment now, the official unemployment rate in the range of 9 to 10%. And if you add in disguised unemployment and part-time workers, we're talking 15, 16, maybe 18% of the labor force. That's an enormous number of people. Unemployment benefits have run out for a lot of people, are going to run out for others. And unemployment benefits are not exactly a luxurious form of living.
Any conversation about unemployment so often gets wrapped up in immigration. We've seen that throughout history in this country. Do you think that we're seeing that again right now?
I think that the presence of high rates of unemployment has in the past, as in the present, catalyzed anti-immigrant sentiments. It is not an accident that the first immigration restriction laws were finally passed really during and in the wake of this very sharp downturn of 1920-1921, the era when Urbain Le Due was auctioning slaves in Massachusetts. Also, however, I think that a lot of the standard reaction, which is we have all these people coming in and people are jobless, I think it's a mistaken image, in part because the people who are coming in are most often not taking the jobs of the people who are jobless. But I think it also misses a key step, and which is important here and which might affect where you would direct your indignation or anger, which is that employers or lots of employers like to have high rates of immigration because they want to have labor available whenever they want it. And that is the vehicle that leads to this conflict between, or perceived conflict between, a shortage of job and people continuing to come in.
Do you think this country has gotten better at treating unemployment and the jobless?
I think that we have routinized the problem and tended to forget about it. I mean, we think of unemployment as the statistic that is announced on television or radio once a month.
The quarterly reporting of unemployment numbers.
Exactly. And is it up or is it down? And really, what's the difference between 9.6 and 9.3? And we lose sight of the fact that people are suffering and people's lives are changed irretrievably. A loss of income for 8 months, I mean, I don't know, but I assume that people working for National Public Radio are not tremendously well paid, but if I lost 8 months of income, that would set me back for quite some time.
Right, there goes the house.
Exactly. And that's true for millions of people, and yet there is no sense of taking full responsibility for it. I mean, for example, it's a slightly unconventional thought, but you could ask the question, why don't we pay unemployed people their full wages and their full salaries? I mean, they're not jobless because of any fault of their own. They're social victims.
Is it as simple as we can't afford it?
I mean, certainly there would be resistance to that effect, and I suspect that the bill would be extremely high if we did that. But then we have to recognize that we're asking these people to pay the bill. Somebody is going to pay the bill, and either society could share it as a whole, or we could have the unemployed pay the bill. And right now, the unemployed are paying a very large share.
Alex Kazar, thank you for coming on Radio Boston.
It's been a pleasure, Sasha.
Alex Kazar is a historian at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and the author of Out of Work, The First Century of Unemployment in Massachusetts. After the break, you know that button you push to get a walk signal at an intersection?
The cars don't have to push a button. They're automatically acknowledged by the system to have a right to go when it's their turn. People ought to be given that option also.
The people for whom the push button pushes their buttons. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back.